It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's Office of Children's Mental Health publishes its annual briefing on the well-being of kids in our state, and we explore takeaways from the report on levels of anxiety, depression, self-harm, other issues as well. Call in with a question. You can share comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Linda Hall is director of the State Office of Children's Mental Health. Linda, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Good to be with you.
So when you look at this year's report and, you know, looking at insights from previous years, which behavioral trends are improving on the upswing among Wisconsin youth in this report?
So the improvement that we saw this year is that the number of low-income youth decreased. And we know that the financial stress on families is an important factor for kids' mental well-being. We think that that decrease occurred because of the pandemic child tax credits. So that number could change again in our next report. Drinking declined among teens. More students are sleeping 8 hours a night, which is really important for well-being. And the investments that the governor and the legislature have made in school social workers, psychologists, and school counselors has led to an increase in those positions at schools in our state, which is really important because the majority of kids who actually get some response to their mental health symptoms have that happen at school. So having people who are able to talk with our youth about their feelings and about their mental health is really important.
It seems,
unfortunately, those numbers are just not, they're not at the recommended rates, but we're pleased to see there has been an increase.
When you talk about schools, that seems to be a theme in this report. What role do schools have in improving children's mental health and the ripple effects of a supportive atmosphere in schools?
Yeah, it's just really fundamental. You know, one of the factors that we look at very carefully is, do children feel like they belong? And one of the most important places for most kids is their school. So a welcoming climate at school is just critical for kids in all kinds of ways. And what we really need right now is for our educators to be able to address the traumas and the mental health issues that kids bring to school with them. That's as important, really, as catching up on academics that lagged a little during the pandemic. Because if kids don't feel well, if they're not awake, they can't learn. And so we know that this climate belonging makes a difference on whether kids show up and then whether they succeed academically.
Okay, so those are some positive movements there. Which behavioral trends among Wisconsin youth are the most concerning as you look at this report?
Well, you know, obviously we're concerned that that our kids continue to be anxious. They feel sad and hopeless every day. And many are considering suicide or, you know, thinking about suicide. We also are seeing a drop in the number of youth participating in extracurricular activities, and which we watch as an indicator also of their feeling of belonging. That participation in extracurricular activities, whether it's sports or theater or music, those are all important for kids, their mental well-being. And so seeing some decline in those numbers is concerning. We're also seeing that vaping has doubled among teens. And we know that that's really a problem for the long term, for their health for the long term. And there are concerns about what are in those vaping materials. So, and then when we look at our LGBTQ youth, almost half of them have considered suicide. Mm. And so that, again, is a question of, do they feel valued? Do they feel like they belong?
We're discussing youth mental health in Wisconsin, a new report with Linda Hall, who leads the Office of Children's Mental Health. And you can join in questions and comments at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Why are only half of children with a diagnosed mental health condition receiving treatment? What is the disconnect there?
Problem that we do not have enough mental health professionals to meet the demand for that service. And we know that our younger generations are talking about mental health. They are more open to treatment than previous ones. So that feeds into the demand. But, you know, this problem of a shortage of mental health professionals is not one that we are going to solve quickly. And kids are growing up now, and we need to pay attention now and find ways to reach them now, which is why our office is really actively engaged with the Coalition on Expanding School-Based Mental Health and the Department of Public Instruction to support mental health navigators and therapists at schools to help get to kids, provide some support for them earlier on so that they don't develop more serious long-term mental illness.
The 1 in 10 teens attempting suicide in 2021, that is alarming. What can Wisconsin systems do to intervene and to change that trajectory?
Well, you know, all these factors about addressing mental wellness and having kids get support, have people they can talk to, know where to go for help. That makes a difference. The belonging makes a difference. We are also going to be training some teens in a newer approach to suicide prevention, which is commonly known as alternatives to suicide. And that's a newer approach to talk, have a different conversation with kids than has been done in the past. Previously, the focus has been find out if this person is thinking about suicide and then get them to a mental health professional. This approach is more like talk with the person, and you know, maybe it's your friend at school, and find out what's the issue that's really making them think about suicide, and do some problem solving with them on whether you can fix that situation or moderate that feeling so that kids don't move to suicide. We have to say, you know, if the data also show that girls are more likely to self-harm, whether that's cutting or poison or other harming strategies. Boys are more likely to use a gun. And so the outcome of attempted suicide with a gun is more likely to be fatal. So all the issues around keeping guns locked and properly stored are really important for a suicide.
When you look at these new interventions and being student-led, school-based, you know, peers talking with their peers, you're also seeing, a lot of these peer-led wellness programs in districts and in schools around the state. What momentum is happening there?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, we have been studying what are the things that make a difference in kids' well-being, we really started a focus on social connectedness of youth. And as we did that, we looked around to see what's happening in the state. And we have categorized, we found that over 300 programs of youth-led mental health programs in their schools. And that's so exciting to us because we know that it's not only the information that kids will get from that, the support they will get from that, the effect it will have on their climate, their school climate. It also is providing leadership skills for them. And just the fact of working, you know, having voice and being heard, developing leadership skills are also very important factors for well-being. And they develop, youth develop skills that make them feel better and help them as even as they move into adulthood. Those kind of things have a lasting effect on kids. So we're really excited about that, and we've decided that we are going to invest heavily in Youth Voice in the spring, throughout this year, throughout 2024. And we are beginning to bring together some of the leaders from those student organizations to convene, to learn from each other, to learn, get more information, and to give them an opportunity to raise their voice on what's important to mental health and how, and their perspectives, their solutions for the youth mental health crisis that we're currently in.
Linda Hall is director of the State Office of Children's Mental Health as we examine this new report and what is affecting young Wisconsinites. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new state report examines the extent of mental health challenges among Wisconsin youth and what factors impact well-being. Linda Hall directs the State Office of Children's Mental Health, which is out with its annual report called Connections Are the Destination. And you can call in with a question. You can share your perspective at any point, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Judy in Fitchburg. Judy, hi, go ahead.
Good morning. I am one of the founding members of Horizon High School and am on the board. Horizon High School is the only recovery high school for students in Wisconsin. Most of our, or many of our students have, want to be free of addiction and have co-occurring mental health disorders. We do have a full-time therapist on staff. Most of our students come from surrounding school districts and are referred to our school by the school districts. We're a nonprofit. The school districts pay a portion of the costs of the students, and we raise the rest of the money. In the past legislative session, a bill was passed to fund recovery schools and fund the development of them around the state, giving grant money for communities who want to provide this service for their children to start planning to have these schools.
And Judy, of course, I would imagine you support this grant funding, which is about $500,000, I believe. We talked recently about Horizon High School. I want to toss this over to Linda Hall. What do you see in recovery high schools?
Well, I just want to say that I was very pleased to be able to learn a little bit more about Horizon High School and talk to some of the students who had wonderful things to say about the program there. It was very impressive that they were, the students I talked to felt so welcomed, and they felt that that was a really important piece of what was going on for them, that they were heard and that they were not judged, and that was really supporting their recovery. Obviously, young people, like adults, often use drugs and other medications to self-medicate when they can't get their mental health issues addressed. So more opportunities for kids to take advantage of this kind of support is just really important.
Judy, thank you for that call. Turning to childcare, the report lists several stressors affecting Wisconsin families, one being the childcare crisis. How do constraints on childcare affect a child's mental health?
Well, we know that, you know, the early in the early childhood is the most important part of when our brains grow, right? That's when brain development mostly happens. It's also in childcare that we are teaching kids how to communicate, how to resolve conflicts with friends, how to, you know, address things that are a problem for them. And so we really need our childcare educators to be informed about brain development, to be informed about mental health and behaviors, and how behaviors are often a way for a child to tell us how they're feeling, what's going on with them. So we want our educators to have not only the information about that, but the space and the time to deal with it. And unfortunately, we have a situation where our child care educators are not paid enough to stay in the field for very long and develop these kinds of experiences with kids. So, when kids can't get, you know, when parents can't get their kids into a child care center, it affects their ability to work. And as I mentioned previously, you know, when families are financially stressed, kids are more likely to have mental health issues. In fact, you know, food insecurity is one of the things to watch for in terms of whether a child is doing well or not. You know, I think one thing we learned during the pandemic is that we all have to invest in our mental health, right? We all had to figure out how we were going to be healthy when we were at home under really different circumstances. This is true for kids. You know, we focus on connections because we know that it's connections that make the brain work well. And it's investing in those connections, investing in physical well-being, you know, getting the proper sleep, eating good food. All of those things make a difference in terms of mental wellness. And we want to build a strong foundation for kids, and we want to start that in the early years. And unfortunately, we have too many parts of the state that are a childcare desert, especially in rural areas.
Talking with Linda Hall, who leads the Office of Children's Mental Health, new report on the status of youth mental health in Wisconsin. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Turning to housing, last fall, our show discussed the rise of doubled up homelessness among Wisconsin youth, meaning students may be living with other families. And I want to just hear from Christine Nadelsky now, a coordinator for the state's Education for Homeless Children and Youth program, talking about this issue.
It really is kind of that hidden homelessness that we don't think about. A lot of times people just think homelessness is an individual on the street or maybe folks living in their car. But really, these doubled up situations are very unstable.
So how is the Office of Children's Mental Health working to strengthen housing stability for youth?
Well, you know, Kate, we take a really collective impact approach to how we work on these issues related to children's mental health. And part of that means that we convene stakeholders from a broad range of agencies and systems to keep them informed about the connections to children's mental health and to scheme with them to improve the whole system. And housing is very important. When kids have stable housing, they have better mental health. They have better physical health. They attend school more, you know, more regularly, and they perform better academically. So it's one of the many systems issues that we are always in conversation with about and looking for ways to build a stronger foundation for our kids.
And this look back at 2023 coincided with Governor Evers declaring last year as the year of mental health, which gave your office a unique opportunity to address the mental health focus of children. Do you consider 2023 a successful year for youth mental health?
I do, in terms of that the fact that more people are engaged on this issue, more people are talking about it. We are able to make some new investments in children's mental health. Obviously, the demand and the crisis is still very large in mm-hmm. Wisconsin and throughout the nation. So we're going to continue in 2024 to consider this a top priority because it's just so critical for our future.
In our few moments we have left together, students say they have fewer trusted adults in their lives. And I just want to land on that because this is so important. What might that indicate?
Well, I think it indicates that you know, when they go to school, perhaps the teachers and the staff there don't have as much time to, you know, stop and listen to them. I think that all of our interactions with people changed a little bit during the pandemic. We're hearing that adults who work with kids are also having to help kids learn how to be in person with other kids and with themselves, and how to put down their phones. We know that overuse of social media and digital equipment is not helpful.
Linda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Linda Hall, Director of the State Office of Children's Mental Health. If you or someone you know is dealing with thoughts of suicide, call or text 988. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kend. Wisconsin's lakes are routinely freezing later in the winter. We discuss with the state climatologist in this cold snap. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a reflection on parenthood.
The quiet, snowy days of winter have a way of compelling us to reflect on our lives. For writer Jill Sisson Quinn, a sledding excursion in central Wisconsin with her son teaches a bittersweet lesson of growing and letting go.
For a state mostly flattened by a glacier, finding a good sled hill can be a problem. My son and I can walk through the cornfield behind our house to a gentle slope, or drive to Nelsonville, where a steep hill descends to a refurbished playground. Soon enough, the walkable hill loses its luster, and my son prefers Nelsonville for more thrills. Then, he wants to sled with friends, not me. He's still too young to just drop off, so I'm often stuck there as the chilly chauffeur, where, watching them, I must throw caution to the wind and let kids be kids. Each time we arrive, my son scans the hill for school friends. One day, some middle school boys he doesn't recognize sit in a circle mid-hill around their snowboards. My son, a second grader, is taller than some of them. We trek up the hill, and one of the boys nods at my son's snowboard and says in greeting, "What's your best trick?" "Jump turn," my son replies, without missing a beat. I imagine he's making this phrase up, and I doubt he can do it because he's spent only 2 days practicing with the snowboard on a frozen snowdrift in the yard. But he answers with such definitiveness, the older boy seems convinced, and we walk by, having gained entry to use the hill, it seems. My son would rather watch the older boys than use his board. I sit in the cold snow, feeling like I'm at a party I wasn't invited to. Odd, after so many years of that symbiotic relationship one has with infant and toddler-aged children. I notice the boys, my son included, gathering at a picnic table near the playground. After some struggle, they manage to pull it several yards so the top of the table is flush with the lip of a snow ramp they have previously built at the hill's bottom. My initial thought is to march over and say, "Uh-uh, put that table back where it was." After all, I'm the only adult around. Someone's going to break their neck. Isn't it my responsibility to put a stop to this? But another part of me knows that soon enough I'll be dropping my son off at this hill and leaving like the parents of these older kids. I won't always be around, won't know what's going on. And isn't it their responsibility to challenge themselves, to try new things, to know when not to? I look around, half hoping a window will go up in one of the houses and a parent will start yelling. But the homes are shut tight against the cold. The boys and I seem to be the only people on this frozen planet. I make a quick decision not to say anything, fully aware it may be the wrong one. I watch the group walk to the top of the hill and get on their boards. At first, they glide down and go to the right or left of the ramp, checking things out, except for my son, who continues as spectator. Then, one boy goes all the way down the hill, up the ramp, across the table, and lands deftly on his feet. a few others follow. No one wipes out. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. The formulation of an idea, the cooperation to create the challenge, the initial caution, and the pure and easy athleticism of the body when all it is doing is growing and growing and growing. I think about my son's entry into this world of tricks, of cooperation and competition, of finding his place amongst peers. I feel moored by both his confidence and caution. Still, I breathe in a long, slow breath, one I may not exhale for many years.
Jill Sisson-Quinn is a writer who lives in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about ice cover on Wisconsin lakes amid climate change. The National Weather Service's Great Lakes Ice Outlook says the Arctic blast underway has resulted in ice starting to form on the Great Lakes. Call in with a question. Share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve Vavaris is Wisconsin State Climatologist and a senior scientist at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me again.
So the National Weather Service report near record high temperatures in our state in December. But here we are in the midst of this brutal cold snap. Have most Wisconsin lakes frozen over?
Yes, by now they have. It was a sudden deep freeze. Things were looking very open, at least in many parts of the state, until last week. And now with this bitter air mass, we've kind of changed the script quickly. And all of the lakes in Wisconsin are now frozen.
So there's this extensive and rich history on ice on Madison's Lake Mendota that dates back the record to 1855. When does Lake Mendota in particular usually freeze?
Well, that's a good question. If you look at the long-term normal going back to the 1850s, the average date is around the winter solstice, around December 20th, 21st. But the new normal in the warmer climate is much later than that, and we've had plenty of January freeze-ups in recent years.
How indicative is Lake Mendota of what happens on other lakes in the state? Is Lake Mendota's records more broadly applicable?
It's a pretty good record. We are limited by the fact that Lake Mendota is in the southern part of Wisconsin, so it doesn't represent the climate everywhere. But one of the big advantages of Mendota, unlike lakes elsewhere in the state, is that we have this really long and continuous record of ice formation and ice melt. Other lakes in the state, they may have spotty records or they may not have records at all. And so this is one of the really most unusual kinds of climate records we have, a 170-year-long continuous record, which is unusual not just for the state, but for the whole country and really for the whole world.
And so the records for other lakes, for thousands of other lakes in Wisconsin, aren't nearly as extensive and accurate?
That's right. So you might have some spotty records for many years. You might have a really dedicated observer who's recording when the lake freezes and when it thaws. But then that person might move, they might die, somebody else might not pick up the records. And so what's annoying if you're a climatologist is having gaps in the record where you have 10, 20 years where you have no information. And so that's one of the benefits not only of Lake Mendota in Madison, but also Lake Monona and smaller Lake Wingra. So even though it may seem like we have a Madison bias, it's mostly just because the records are so rich around there.
Does that have to do with the university there and the extensiveness of limnology through generations?
Exactly. People often say Lake Mendota is the most studied lake in the world.
Yes.
This is one more example of that. And in addition, there used to be a real economic value or importance to lake ice because people used to harvest it for ice boxes. And the Madison Lakes were considered some of the best ice around, and it would be shipped in rail cars to different parts of the country. And so, you know, those times are long gone, but that's another reason why careful ice records were important back in the day.
Has Lake Mendota ever remained unfrozen during a winter?
It has not. That's one of the interesting things about our long climate record. Back in the winter, very warm winter of 2001-2002, it was open all of February, which was incredible. But then we had a late freeze in early March, and it froze for 2 or 3 weeks before finally melting for good. But that's the closest we've come to an ice-free winter.
When do scientists consider a lake to be frozen? How do you define that freeze date?
It's difficult, and this is another one of the reasons why it's hard to compare ice records from one lake to another. One observer might say, well, if it's 50% or more ice cover, judging by eye, we'll call it closed. Other people might be more strict. Other people might be more loose. For lakes Wingra and Monona, we try to use a 50% threshold for determining ice freeze up. But for Mendota, we have a different criterion, and that is that we consider it frozen when we think a boat would not be able to go from Picnic Point over to either Maple Bluff or Governor's Island because there's too much ice. So if that transect is frozen over, we consider Lake Mendota to be ice covered.
And then thaw dates, do you have a similar type of setup?
It is a similar type of setup, although we don't actually go out on a boat to determine it. But the point is that we're trying to maintain the same methodology that we think people used 100, 150 years ago. If somebody gave the state climatology office a fancy drone where we could fly over the lake and get a really good determination of the melt off or freeze up, that would be more accurate. But then we wouldn't be able to be consistent with the older records.
Oh, I see. So why is ice important to lakes in Wisconsin?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. Depending on the size of the lake, it can affect lake effect snow. For example, Buffalo just got hammered with a big snowstorm last weekend, and they're about to get hit with another one today. And that's directly a result of there not being much ice on Lake Erie. And so if you have one of the Great Lakes that's open, that produces a lake effect snow machine when conditions are right. But for smaller lakes in Wisconsin, say inland lakes, lake ice is really important for recreation. People love to skate and ice fish. It's important for the economy because so much of Wisconsin, especially northern Wisconsin, depends on winter tourism. A lot of that involves ice fishing, for example, even community festivals, ice sculpting and so forth. And there's important ecological effects of ice cover. It affects the thermal stratification or the temperature changes of the lake with depth. And it also affects oxygen input into the lakes and also competition among different fish types, warm-loving fish and cold type of fish. So it has all sorts of ramifications.
Steve Vavaris is Wisconsin State Climatologist and our guide to what affects ice cover on Wisconsin lakes and in the historical record. Call in with a question or comments at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists track ice cover on Wisconsin lakes, helping to determine climate patterns, lake water levels, and the larger ecological effects. And Wisconsin State Climatologist Steve Vavaris fields your questions about lake ice amid a warming planet. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve, you talk about lake effect snow, the impacts on Buffalo, New York, and Lake Erie there in the mix. Closer to home, let's talk about the ice cover on the Great Lakes. Is there substantial ice on Lake Michigan now?
The Great Lakes is also very slow to form ice this year. Right now, the Great Lakes basin-wide only have about 5% ice covered area, compared to 20% on average for this date. And there was a big news story on New Year's Day saying that over the last 50 years of record keeping, there was less than 0.5% of ice cover on the Great Lakes, which was a record low. Typically, there would be about 9% by then. So just like in Wisconsin, the Great Lakes as a whole has been very slow to form ice this winter.
What might be happening there?
Well, again, it's the warmth. Statewide, we were the warmest December on record in Wisconsin, about 15 degrees warmer than normal. And that was true not only here, but over the upper Midwest as well. And so, it's, you know, really ice formation depends on pretty much just two variables, one being air temperature and the other being lake depth. A shallow lake freezes sooner. Deep lakes take longer, and of course, the Great Lakes are much deeper than most of our Wisconsin lakes, especially Lake Superior.
Yeah, how about Lake Superior? Being so cold as it is, what are the impacts of ice cover there?
One of the impacts for Lake Superior, as our northern listeners know, is lake effect snow. And because Lake Superior is so deep, even though it's probably the coldest climate among the Great Lakes, it often is the last to freeze or the smallest area to freeze during a cold winter. And so as long as you have a lot of open water and we get Arctic air masses coming down as we have in the past week, that's a great setup for lake effect snow. The warm lake waters transfer their moisture into the atmosphere, and then it turns into snow and sometimes heavy snow downstream.
And snow is such a significant insulator as well. So what effect does snow have on lakes and ice cover?
Yes, yeah, snow complicates ice cover. So it can act as an insulator on ice, just like it acts as an insulator on land. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to get ice to grow quickly, the best conditions are to have ice form when there's no snow around and let it thicken on its own, not having an insulating layer of snow on top of it. So in terms of the freeze-up we just had in Madison recently, it's fortunate if we want to get some thick ice that the snow storms that we had last week preceded the ice formation, because right now there's little, if any, snow cover on the initial ice formation, and that allows the ice to grow as quickly as possible right now during this cold snap.
So thick ice, how does one check the thickness of lake ice?
Well, carefully, yes. Always you have to be careful going out on lakes, but it's typically done with an auger, and you can just drill down and simply measure it. Ice anglers are very familiar with doing this, and so it's very low tech, but it's also very accurate. And there are models that can be used to estimate ice thickness that are based mainly on the overlying air temperature over time. But there's no substitute for actually going out in the field and going out and getting an ice measurement to know how thick the ice is at your location.
I would imagine that the shallower shoreline would freeze first. Is that right?
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's fortunate, because that's typically where you want to go if you're ice fishing rather than going way out into the lake. So that is a good thing. And it also is good that thin ice grows quicker. So the thinner the ice is, the faster it can grow at a given air temperature. And so that's right why the ice right now should be thickening very quickly as we get this cold snap upon ice formation. And generally, it's considered 4 inches of ice thickness is safe to walk on. Before you get to 4 inches, you better be very careful or just stay off it at all.
As you look at the Great Lakes in comparison to smaller inland lakes we have in Wisconsin, does ice cover on smaller inland lakes, does that have any effect on the weather or on lake effect?
Not really. You need a bigger lake, the size of a Great Lake, to have an impact on lake effect snow. If you live right near one of the Wisconsin inland lakes, especially a larger one, you might get some extra ice fog on a cold winter morning, you know, local effects of cloudiness, but not enough to actually produce lake effect snowfall. Occasionally, you get some strange phenomena, like around Lake Mendota. It's been documented that you can get some ice quakes, they're called, kind of like earthquakes, mm-hmm. when there's convergence of the ice in just the right way during the winter, and it can actually shake the ground. But that's a rare occurrence, and it's very localized.
Oh, that's fascinating. As we talk about lake ice, Steve Vavras is a Wisconsin State climatologist. Join in questions and thoughts, 800-642-1234. Steve, will winters without frozen lakes or short periods of frozen lakes become more common in Wisconsin due to climate change?
I think they will. We've seen a pronounced change in the winter climate over the last 25 years. It's almost like a regime shift for generally warmer winters in Wisconsin. And we have had some exceptions within there, but generally the winters have been considerably warmer than in the years prior to 1998. And that's reflected in the Madison ice records for Lake Mendota with later freeze-ups and earlier thaws. And it's also interesting because Lake Geneva, nearby far southeast Wisconsin, has pretty good ice records as well. And we know that it has remained unfrozen during four winters this century, so since 2000. And that is really significant in terms of a climate change signal to actually remain unfrozen for the entire winter. And I know, you know, if you have a lake or a winter ice festival or snow festival around Lake Geneva like they have, that's not really great news.
Considering the climate is in an El Nino cycle, did that cause a delay in lakes freezing this year, or is this due strictly to climate change?
It's a good question. It's really hard to determine how much of a role El Nino has played this winter. When we have strong El Ninos, as we have this winter, we often do have milder winters, but there have been exceptions too. And when we look at some of the latest ice freezes on record for Mendota back 2007, 1932, even 2002, those were either very weak El Nino winters or not El Ninos at all. So El Nino is not the only show in town. There are all sorts of other weather factors that affect our winter climate here.
In our last seconds together, you know, it's cold, very cold now, but we're looking at a significant temperature shift to the high 30s next week. How do frequent temperature swings affect lake ice cover?
Well, the ice cover has some memory, so even when it warms up next week, it's still going to be we're still going to have some ice that thickened up during this cold snap. So it doesn't have an immediate effect as much as one might think. And so hopefully we can thicken up the ice this week, a reinforcing shot of Arctic air coming down on Friday, so that it can be still pretty strong and thick to survive next week's warm up.
Okay, so ice cover having a bit of a muscle memory there, some durability.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Steve Vavras is Wisconsin State climatologist and a senior scientist at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. Steve Vavras also co-directs the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the physical and mental hardship of migrant laborers toiling in Wisconsin fields, the efforts to organize around improved wages, humane living conditions, and respect for workers. That dates back over 50 years. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jesus Salas is author of a memoir called Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement. Jesus, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Your memoir begins with your family in South Texas, Crystal City, and you take us then to the fields of Wisconsin in 1950s Midwest. Why did you decide to begin your story there?
Well, actually, I'm a third generation migrant worker. My father and my mother had traveled to Wisconsin as migrants in the early 40s. My brother was born here in 1942. My uncle signed up for Selective Service several months after Pearl Harbor and served with the Wisconsin Red Arrow Division in the Pacific. But the war intervened and they returned to Texas. And we don't start again until, as you cite, the 50s, when our family is now six boys and my mom and dad.
Your grandfather taught your father the route to get to the Great Lakes. What route would your family take to travel to Wisconsin? What was that caravan like?
Well, my grandfather had crossed from the state of Coahuila, the bordering state, Texas, in 1906. Artesian water had been found, and they were looking for Mexican laborers to spread that resource throughout the floodplains, semi-arid but very fertile land, and he homesteaded there for several generations until the Great Depression. And that's when he was forced to leave the area and look for work in order to make a living. So he starts by going to the Texas counties, Gulf Coast counties first, then to the Panhandle, where large tracts of land were being put under cultivation. And if you've ever traveled...
Oh, I think we just...
Hello.
Hi. Okay, we just lost you momentarily there, Jesus. Go ahead on those travels.
Sorry.
Yes, no, that's okay.
Well, we if you've ever traveled from here to the borderlands, the point of Texas, and you get to the Panhandle, you're only halfway there. So from the Panhandle, he shows my father how to get first to the Plain States and then to Wisconsin, to the Great Lakes region.
Wow. And you mentioned this 3-day, 1,500-mile caravan trip from Crystal City and then getting to Wisconsin and Hartford. What was that like for you to go on that trip over years as a young child?
Well, we were all huddled in the back of this 2.5-ton tandem truck, so with a canvas covered top. And all that I wanted to do most of all, because I wanted to see where we were traveling for these several days, was to see where we were going, because we were all covered. So that because we children knew how to speak English and were learning how to read and write it, as new members of the caravan, or new members of the crew joined us, my father farmed us out. And because we could read maps, they assigned us to different people who had never made the trip before. And we guided them with maps at the stops where we stopped to fill up with gas. We would help them with the change and the purchasing of goods during the travel, that kind of thing. So that was the best thing that happened to me during those trips. At least I could see where I was going. And, of course, I was helping other crews or families that were coming into our crew that didn't know how to get here and couldn't read maps.
Because it was possible to get lost in those times.
Well, this is, if you recall, the interstate system is built in the 50s, mm-hmm. and there was just constant construction of the two-lane highways that permeated the landscape at that time, so that there were detours all over the place. So it was very important to get somebody to guide these new families that were coming in and to read the signs and to follow the roads and to stay within the caravan, yes.
Jesus Salas is a labor organizer and author of a memoir, Obreros Unidos, as we talk about the history of the first farm workers union in Wisconsin. You can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jesus, migrant farm workers were organized into crews to do the agricultural work. What was the structure for your family's working crew?
Well, since we worked with other crews, let's say, for instance, when we harvested cotton, The crews were segregated into the African-American crews and the Anglo crews and the Mexican crews. In the Cucumbers, of course, there were crews from the Texas Valley, and we were from Crystal City. So the way we were set up is that the males and the our fathers were uncles were on the outside of the crew. Then on the inside were the unmarried women, and then the younger children close to our mothers and our aunts. And so when I start writing about the working conditions, I speak of women because that's who I started to work. I started to work alongside them because I was one of the younger ones, and my older brothers were towards the end of the crew, along with the single males and my father and uncles.
What was it like to weed sugar beets in Wisconsin and using a hoe?
Well, at that time, there wasn't a very extensive use of herbicides, so that we had to remove all of the noxious weeds and grasses from the plant and also space them. And since we were the work crews were family based, and it was about women and children working in the field, so our fathers would take the long holes and cut them to approximately 20 inches, so that because we didn't have the upper strength to be able to handle the long holes, they'd cut the small holes, these long holes into small ones. And then we would be hoeing, standing over the rows of sugar beets and swinging at the weeds to remove them from the plant. So it was very arduous work. It was backbreaking work because we were stooped over most of the day, and it was at the end of the day we could hardly even stand up or walk very straight.
You write about the mental toll migrant workers took on your mother and your aunt. How did the work affect their mental health? I think you used the word that the mental anguish of work was like a communicable disease.
Well, I had never seen my aunt and my mother in that state. And here we were working in the fields. Let's say, for instance, I think I was speaking when I was talking about them. We were in Henry, Illinois. We were harvesting asparagus. By the way, we wouldn't come directly to Hartford, Wisconsin. We would stop in Henry, Illinois to harvest asparagus because the frost would thaw out earlier there, and the asparagus shoots would come out. So we would get several weeks of work there before we actually came to Hartford. So that that reference that I make to my mom and my aunts was during the asparagus harvest in Henry, Illinois, and there was no electricity in the labor camp. There was no running water. There was no sewer. So that not only did our parents have to get up early in the morning, get the wood stove going, because of course the kerosene stove just wouldn't heat the stove fast enough for us to eat before going to work, and go out and work all day and then come in and not only cook for us in the before putting us to bed, but then having to wash our clothes. And since there was no hot running water, they built these huge cauldrons of water to boil and then put our clothes in there, and with a stick move them around in the soapy water. In other words, it was nonstop work for them, and I note in my writings how their demeanor started to change. And you know, at that time there were no words for the mental conditions of any of us, including the mental conditions of our women. The words for loco, crazy, or loca, you know, for a female just didn't apply. But I start trying to look at their faces and define what was happening to them. And I can't do it because there are just no words. And of course I was looking for words that we commonly use now as stress, those kinds of mental conditions as such. And I speak about my mother having to suffer an operation, and I going and seeing her in a nearby town of Peoria. And you know, those flimsy nightgowns that they put on patients. I just couldn't stand to look at my mother.
Yeah.
So very very challenging times during our youth at that time, in particular what was happening to our women. And I since I work closest to them, that's who I write about.
You could see those changes, yes. Wisconsin activist and historian Jesus Salas has a memoir. It's called Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement. You can be part of the conversation about migrant worker rights. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dive into the history of the independent agricultural labor union, Obreros Unidos, or Workers United, operated in Wisconsin starting in the late 1960s, and how this early push for better living and working conditions for migrant farm workers is viewed today. Labor leader Jesus Salas has a memoir about this time, and you can join in with a question or share comments, 800-642-1234. Jesus, in 1966, you organized this 80-mile protest march from Wautoma to Madison, and you give credit to the farm worker march by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta as inspiration. What issues were you marching about in Wisconsin at the time?
Well, I didn't go directly from being a farm worker to being a farm worker organizer of a union. The venue for resettlement in Wisconsin was my father acquiring a small six-table cafe in downtown Wautoma, where it was the center of the migrant workers. And as I was working on tables, some individuals from Madison came over and wanted to know if I was one of the Salases who had been a farm worker and if I would take them to the labor camps, because they were organizing a demonstration program for migrant children. And for the next 3 years, I returned to the labor camps, establishing migrant centers. And over 3 years, we established seven centers serving over 100 children. But it was going back to those labor camps, and I viewed the migrant condition completely different than when I was a part of it. Parents started telling me about their wages. I started seeing the housing condition on a broader basis, the unsanitary conditions, migrants complaining. And as I was in Madison in 1965 doing a report on the migrant workers, somebody brought a newspaper from L.A., says, hey, look what the migrant workers are doing in California. And it was Huerta and Chavez leading a march from Delano to Sacramento in protest of the lack of recognition by the grape growers in the grape strike that they had enjoined that year. And so I said, that's what we need to do, just like Chavez is doing in California. So I got on the phone, and at that time, you know, I like to tell my friends, and they just get amazed, that they were actual operators at the time. in the telephone system, and you could make a person-to-person call, and if they didn't find that person, you didn't have to pay for the call. So I called Delano, California, Cesar Chavez, person-to-person call, and they found him. And I told him who it was, and I'd been a migrant worker and gone back to the labor camps and what I had done with the migrant programs, but that I wanted to do what he had done. And if we could use his the Thunderbird symbol, the flag of the National Farm Workers Association, because I wanted to organize a march. And he said that I could, and he asked me if I would support the Great Boycott. So there started the relationship for the next 5 years, where, you know, he mentors me in terms of initiating the labor organization, and he asked me to support him in the Great Boycott. Because at the time, farm workers did not have any rights to organize. If they wanted to have a representation in the union, they were just fired. When the Labor Act was signed in 1935, the Wagner Act, agricultural workers were excluded. But here in Wisconsin, the state and And our forefathers here in Wisconsin established a labor law that covered migrant workers. So the 5 years that we organized farm workers, we were under the purview of the Wisconsin Labor Board. So extraordinary situation of Wisconsin farm workers being able to organize and protected by the law, which Chavez couldn't do in California because we were only of the two states, Wisconsin and Hawaii, who were protected by the labor law.
Jesus Salas with us, labor organizer, author of the memoir Obreros Unidos. Let's take a call now. Mark in Dodgeville. Mark, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
Hello. Oh, yes, I was a friend of Francisco Rodriguez, who Jesus would certainly recognize. For many years, we owned hunting land together here in Wisconsin, and I got the chance to hear all kinds of stories in the old days. The early movement in Texas, La Raza Unida, which means the race united, was bringing people together to vote and run. And Francisco was the first city manager in Crystal City who was not white. There were 90% Hispanic, 10% white, and the white folks, us white folks, ran everything. So he was part of changing that. Then he came to Wisconsin, as Jesus has talked about quite a bit, and settled in here and did a lot to help other migrants come into the area. When he worked for Governor Tony Earl, he was the first Hispanic desk operator contact for the Hispanic community. And he got a law passed through the governor so that anybody going to school in Wisconsin who was a child of migrant laborers or came as a migrant himself or herself could get in-state tuition.
And Mark, how do you think this work, these efforts, have changed Wisconsin, your home?
Well, it's changed in some ways that many Hispanic people and other people, Hmong and others, can come into the state and be more welcomed. And it has failed to change to some extent because there still is a lot of negative feeling among us white people, mostly about other people with accents, with skin colors that are different than ours. So it's been somewhat successful. It's been somewhat unsuccessful. I had hoped when I was younger that racism would die out during my generation. I'm afraid that hasn't happened. But I think that Jesus and Francisco and a number of others have at least brought it part way to where it's not as rampant as it used to be.
Mark, thank you for calling in. Jesus, go ahead. What comes up for you?
Well, the first thing that comes up is that my relationship to the gentleman that he mentioned, that is Francisco Rodriguez. We were both fellow farm workers here in Crystal City. We only lived blocks from each other. His father was a barber and a dear friend of my father, as was his mother with relationship with my mother. The important thing, I think, in addition to the contribution that Francisco and other migrant workers of that generation made, was Mark's reference to Francisco going back to Texas and helping the Mexican-American political movement down there. Or that is what Mark is referring to, is that not only is this a transnational movement, or that is the Chavez energizing the farm workers movement here in California and Texas, et cetera, but it's a transnational one, or that is the farm workers that organized here in Wisconsin went back since they were seasonal, and initiated political activities. And in our hometown, Francisco actually goes back and becomes the first city manager after cutting his teeth here in Obreros Unidos, or that is, in the farm workers movement. Great story. I'm glad that Mark brought that up, because it's a unique story in that these individuals are getting involved in the union here or going back to Texas and going back to Crystal City and getting the vote out and doing other organizing activities that enhance their political status of their respective communities.
And that is labor leader Jesus Salas, who is sharing an inside look at the farm workers movement in Wisconsin and in Texas, his memoir called Obreros Unidos. Be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And we heard from Buzz, who emailed to say that they hoed beets for years in the Red River Valley in North Dakota, said It was hard work, and now the harvest of beets is all mechanical. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Labor leader Jesus Salas writes about the hardship of migrant workers and early efforts to organize. Salas's parents were drawn to Wisconsin's fertile fields for cultivating sugar beets and picking cucumbers and tomatoes by hand. His memoir is called Obreros Unidos, or Workers United. It's the labor union he co-founded in the 1960s. Call in with a question. Share thoughts in this discussion. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jesus, take us to the Libby's walkout in 1967. You organize a migrant farm workers walkout against the large food processor. What was your goal for this walkout?
Well, we had the protest march that we initiated in 1966 was a demand for enforcement of Wisconsin progressive legislation, minimum wage, housing codes, workman's compensation, et cetera. That fall, we went out on strike against a potato processor and completely inexperienced in terms of organizing a farm workers union. But we learned the hard way. And there are two things that happened. The other one was John Schmidt, the president of was elected president of the AFL-CIO, provided us with legal assistance so that we actually had a very concrete idea as to how to organize the union. And the organization the following year in 1967 against Libby's, we were represented by the lawyers who actually represented the state AFL-CIO and guided us through the process. We asked for an emergency certification election. We went out on walkout, but unlike the previous year in the potato processing, we call it a walkout because we went right back in. We didn't want the workers to be prejudiced or to suffer any consequences for walking out. We went to work the next day, but we brought attention to the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission to call an emergency certification election, an emergency because of the perishable nature of the cucumbers. And Libby was the biggest employer in central Wisconsin. Of the 5,000 workers, they employed over 700, so we wanted to go right to the top. Some individuals criticized me and said you should have started with some of the smaller processors and establish your ground game there instead of going after the multinationals. But we went after Libby's, we got the certification election, and we won the election 405-8. Or that almost a unanimous voting by the farm workers that they wanted Obreros Unidos to represent them. And we got ready to negotiate the first contract for the labor union here in the Midwest. And we met, and when we met with the Libby negotiators, they handed us a letter saying that they were pulling all their operations out of the state of Wisconsin and moving them to the Carolinas. And
where there wasn't that type of unionization going on.
Well, we sued them and petitioned the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission to respond to our petition because we said that they were moving their operations to avoid the union, and they said they were moving their operations just for a bottom line because they thought that they could harvest the cucumbers cheaper in the Carolinas than they could here. Well, the case just held up our organizational activities in the field. So the following year, Libby had three processing plants, the largest one in Hartford. So the following years, we said, all right, so you don't want to recognize our union in the fields, we'll organize your processing plants. So we organized three walkouts in their three processing plants. And again, to no avail. And that's when Chavez tells us, look, Jesus, if you help me, this is a crucial year. This is now the fifth year going into the boycott. If you help me win in the boycott in California, once we win in California, I'll help you win in Wisconsin. Well, I don't know why I believed them, but I believed them. I didn't know it was going to take another a couple of years to win the Great Boycott. But I moved to Milwaukee to organize the Great Boycott. And at that time, Wisconsin was crucial because not only did we consume large quantities of grapes, we consume more brandy than anybody per capita in the state of Wisconsin, if you can believe it, Kate. So here I go to Wisconsin, and what's going on to Milwaukee? What's going on? Father Grappi and the commandos have been 200 consecutive days marching for open housing, and there the farm workers and the Black Civil Rights Movement intersect, because I am hosted at 524 West National. They provide offices, the Archdiocese funded program there. Three blocks down the street, Father Grappi's marching from the north side to picket Ellen Bradley, at that time now Rockwell Standard, because of the 6,000 workers. There's only a handful of Blacks and Latinos. So,
Jesus, what stands out to you from working with Father James Grappi, the Catholic priest, the noted civil rights leader, and in supporting the civil rights movement? What did you learn from Father Grappi?
Well, the I had met Lloyd Barbee before, and I knew that he was suing the Milwaukee public school system for the desegregation of the Milwaukee public schools. So I was involved with that, and eventually petitioned in the lawsuit that bilingual faculty and eventually the bilingual program would be started. With Father Grappi, one of the most extraordinary things, and one of the things that I bring in the book, because as I was reading about Father Grappi, there was just such a negative view of his efforts. Then I talk about his personality, about how gregarious he was, how lighthearted he was. So the laugh that he had, how he just, enlivened the whole crew. He had joined the picket line at Cole Food Store when we were picketing over there on Capitol Drive. So we started working together. We marched together to Madison to the when the welfare marches during the welfare cuts were going on at that time, and we got removed by the National Guard. He eventually, the legislature sued him and enjoined him for the march.
Can we pause right there? Because I wonder, yeah, how did the Welfare Mothers March on Madison, and as you talk about the Milwaukee Open Housing Marches, how did that intersect with the work to advance migrant worker rights in?
The 524 West National in Milwaukee is only several blocks where the United Migrant Opportunity Services grant program had been funded. Mm-hmm. And so I would walk over there, just as I had walked over three blocks to meet Grappi, to the United Migrant Opportunity Service. And they were teed off in that all of the Anglos, all of the administrators were Anglo, and all the field workers were Mexican, and the mission statement was the poor should help themselves. If you recall, that was the whole mantra of the war on poverty. And here there were no migrant workers on the board. So I started getting involved with the migrant worker program in addition to working with Father Grappi. And one of the things that the way these things conjoin is that in the resettlement program, the state of Wisconsin administered to the county of Milwaukee would assist resettling immigrant workers, and so that UMass depended on the resettlement programs of the efforts for migrant workers who were being displaced by automation, and the support by the county of Milwaukee as the welfare funds were being provided, so that the cutting of the welfare funds affected the resettlement programs of former migrant workers who were being displaced, and that's how I got involved, how I joined the effort for the welfare marches, because it was impacting on our resettlement and retraining of former migrant workers in Milwaukee and Wisconsin.
When you cut ties with Cesar Chavez in California, there were tensions that arose between the two of you, and you eventually stopped coordinating with the grape boycott. Why did you two disagree?
Because he wanted me to focus completely on the grape boycott. And here I was getting involved with the civil rights movement and helping out the workers in United Migrant Opportunity Services in the winter time. Like Mark mentioned, our organizers were going back, former migrant workers were going back home in Texas and getting involved in political activities, and I'd go down there with them. I spent my winters down there organizing. We could never organize the Libby's 700 workers in a 6-7 weeks period of time. So I would organize migrants in the wintertime down there. So I continued to do that. And Chavez didn't like that. He said, you said you were going to help me with a great boycott. What are you doing, you know, organizing and getting involved in political activities in your hometown in Texas? So that's where the tension began. But it was an amicable kind of a breakup. I just couldn't give up the activities that were going on from my homies in South Central Texas, former migrant workers like myself, and their activities with GRAPI and the United Migrant Opportunity Services in Milwaukee. And so that's when we started breaking up. And I said, Chavez, this is as far as I'm going to go with a great boycott. I'll continue on a part-time basis, and we did. I continued working on the Great Boycott until 1970, when we won the first contract, but not traveling like on his behalf, where I would go to Philadelphia, I would go to Chicago, I would go, you know, travel all over pursuing the Great Boycott. I stayed pretty much between Texas and Wisconsin.
Jesus Salas's memoir, it's called Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement, as we discuss migrant worker activism in Wisconsin through generations. Call in with a question. Share what's on your mind, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore efforts to organize migrant farm workers in central Wisconsin in the 1960s and how an independent union called Obreros Unidos, or Workers United, it laid a foundation for migrant worker rights into the future. Jesus Salas co-founded Obreros Unidos and reflects on this era in a memoir. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jesus, you enrolled at UW-Milwaukee, and you write that there were several barriers to increasing Latino enrollment at the time. What were those challenges like?
Well, while we were migrant workers, everywhere that we went, my father always placed us in school. And as I note, I graduated from Henry, Illinois, grade school, my eighth grade. And my freshman year in high school, I went to three different high schools in three different states. So while I was organizing, I attempted to stay in school, just as my father was very anxious that I stay in college. So it took me 10 years, but I finally ended up here in Milwaukee. In 1968, when I came to organize a Great Boycott, I enrolled at UWM. And out of 25,000 students, as I noted in my book, all of us could sit around one table. All the Latinos could sit around one table. And what became the urgency of the enrollment was not simply that we were being denied access. But when we got involved with UMass and we started insisting that all the social service agencies actually have the poor, or that is the people that they serve in their board, and that there be hiring of Latinos in those social service and educational programs, UWM became essential for the enhancement of their contribution to those agencies, and in fact to the community at large. So that we started to petition the chancellor's office not only to access School for Latinos, but to establish a Spanish-speaking outreach institute that would guide Latinos into financial aid, academic support, et cetera, et cetera.
And what was the resistance like? What went on there?
The resistance wasn't so much that the doors were going to remain closed. We eventually were going to knock them down. But the fact is, we wanted a program. We thought that there was an essential need to create a counseling academic support program to guide the students. You know, at that time, you know, we need to say how segregated the community was. The UWM was on the other side of the planet. There were no communications between Latinos in the near south side, blacks in the north side, and the people who lived in the UWM area. And we wanted to get the Latinos and African Americans to start crossing those viaduct bridges and to start enrolling and participating in the classes that were being offered at UWM. So it was an effort that required us to engage and apply, and we started enrolling the students and demanding the program. And of course, they wouldn't give it to us, so we had to. One of the things that I learned from Father Grappi was direct action. And I had never, you know, the 4 years that I had been involved in the child care programs, 4 years that I had been involved in the union, I had never been in jail. But then when I started organizing here in Milwaukee, I couldn't stay out of jail. We were arrested at the Kohl's food store. We were arrested at UWM. We were arrested in our march for the welfare protest. So,
and you had to be strategic about these arrests and how bail would be posted. What was your approach?
Because the first time I didn't know that if you got arrested on Friday, there was no courts on the weekend. So we just sat around waiting for the judges to show up on Monday. Dumb, right? So we never got arrested again. Every time we went on manifestation, we made sure that there was bail money, that there was attorneys available to represent us, et cetera. Yes, of course, we learned the hard way.
Jesus Salas with us, labor organizer, author of Obreros Unidos. Let's bring in Carla in Stevens Point. Hi, Carla.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
I would just like to bring up that I love your program today. I heard it just by accident, and it reminds me of my childhood. I lived in rural Portage County, small town. We had quite a few migrant workers in the day that would come up. This was back in the 50s and 60s, and they lived in difficult conditions. From my perspective as a kid, I could see that. And sometimes in the winters, they couldn't get back to the area in Texas where they had come from, and they would be stuck in our winters here and with no schooling. The Wisconsin school system or whatever public schools decided that they would have a room, almost like a one-room schoolhouse environment, where they would educate these children. And my mom was hired to be their teacher. She had taught in one-room school, so she knew how to organize that kind of thing. And she was so good. And when I watched her and her close association with public health department, at that time it was Ruth Gilfrey, a great public health nurse here, I learned so much from those two women and how they approached trying to help people without being suspicious of them or backgrounds or anything. Just help to promote public education and public health that lesson stuck with me my whole life.
Oh,
and
Carla,
a lot of them.
Thank you for sharing that story of the rural Portage County in that era. Jesus, go ahead.
Yes, so we were talking about the establishment of the Spanish Speaking Outreach Institute. The enrollment of UWM, I said, wasn't that the chancellor was resisting the access, but it was resisting establishing a program to support those students, encourage them, assist them in financial aid, provide, if necessary, the tutorials that they needed to survive. And we enrolled the students ourselves. We actually did a lot of work ourselves, but the success of the social services programs in the near South Side, including at United Migrant Opportunity Services, and now the wealth of services that we provide is a part of the success story that we established back then, where we enrolled hundreds of these students, and right now there is a network. We have the UMOS, we have the clinic, we have the just go down the line, and all the United Community Center.
And Jesus, we're almost out of time, less than a minute to go. But Andy in Manitowoc called in and wants to know whether the large number of migrants trying to enter the U.S. over the southern border is that affecting the migrant labor movement today.
The back when we were migrant workers, over 100,000 migrants are coming to the Midwest, over 15,000 to Wisconsin. Presently, there's a little less than 5,000 migrant workers that come up, mostly male workers working in the food processing and meat packing, et cetera. There is not as much field work as there used to be when I was working as a migrant, but there's still a great need for field work for migrant workers, especially in the processing plants. There is a cry for additional workers all over the place, and including the working conditions in some of the processing plants and meat packing. You hear about the working conditions. I think that we need to look at those further as these people join that workforce.
Jesus, thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you very much, Kate, for having me.
Jesus Salas, author of Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.